Welcome to the Geopolitical Ecology Podcast, where you will find critical conversations at the intersections of nature, culture, and power.
In this episode, we chat with Holly Cajano about efforts to mobilize towards a just energy transition and the field of city planning in relation to this. Holly discusses with us the various scales, modes of governance, and types of policies coming out of the Green New Deal resolution, or the GND, put forth by AOC and Maki in 2019. She provides an optimistic outlook on the GND as a worker and community-led vision for just transitions, and speaks to how it's influenced future legislation, such as the Inflation Reduction Act. In a few weeks, we will interview Max Isle, author of A People's Green New Deal, to discuss an alternative perspective. In addition to the GND, we cover topics ranging from reducing emissions on university campuses to building a culture of sustainability and community care. Holly Cajano is an assistant professor in climate justice and environmental planning at the University of British Columbia's School of Community and Regional Planning. Her research explores social dimensions of climate transitions in the US and Canada. Her current work investigates how diverse stakeholder groups form coalitions to advocate for energy systems change. This work connects patterns across decision-making scales, exploring the ways individual decision-making influences collective action, and how collective action disrupts existing relations of power in local energy and climate politics. I met Holly in her Just Transitions course at the UBC, where we've talked extensively about how critical geography, urban political ecology, and city planning may inform each other as fields, especially when it pertains to critical questions like balancing the importance of place-based and local contexts with necessary large-scale actions towards an energy transition. I am joined by my co-host friend and comrade, Yusuf, and here is our conversation with Holly. Hello, Holly. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. It's amazing to have you here and very happy to introduce you to Yusuf as well. For a little context, Holly is teaching a course that I'm currently in called Just Transitions in the School of Community and Regional Planning here at UBC. So I know a little bit about city planning just from that course, basically. But I think our listeners and even Yusuf have very little context on what city planning is, but we're, you know, generally curious about different approaches towards social and environmental justice, especially in the context of the city. So could you maybe start by just giving our listeners an overview of what planning is and maybe just summarizing some of the most dominant trends and forms of urban planning in North America over the past few decades and some of the more critical and radical pushbacks as well to these dominant forms?
Yeah, thank you so much, Erica, and nice to meet you, Yusuf. I'm super happy to be here and excited to get into it today and chat a little bit. So I can tell you a little bit about what I do and how I think of planning. I think it's a really interesting subject because there's a lot of debate among planners about what planning is. If you know about kind of your typical like urban planner, you might think about somebody at the municipal level who plans housing and transportation and zoning laws and lots of administrative stuff. But especially when we're in academia and we're thinking more about what planning is as a discipline, I think we're really thinking about what we want our cities and communities to look like. So really future visioning, and by definition, it's future oriented. And so what I do in climate and environmental planning is really thinking about our communities, but how we make decisions about the environment, the natural environment and the built environment, and how humans want to live within that environment. So you asked about trends over the last couple of decades. I think interesting, there's been a lot of kind of hot button buzzwords like smart growth and 15-minute cities that people might be familiar with that have kind of been coming up more and more, which I think these are all ways to really think about how do we want to make cities more sustainable. I think that's been a big trend over the past few decades. But some of the more radical forms of planning that you asked about, I think, is really the trends are looking towards how do you put power back in the hands of community members to make decisions, to set their own priorities, and to have a higher level of autonomy about what they want their place to be.
Very interesting, Holly. Thank you for that. I'm wondering if you could speak more about the dominant car-centric modes of city planning that we see all around us, inherited from the 20th century in North American cities, kind of as a way to provide context to what precedes these trends of sustainable planning and 15-minute cities, etc. I'm just curious what the process of planning was like to yield such results.
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, there's good planning historians that cover some of this kind of stuff, but part of what we're going to talk about today as we get into thinking about how we plan for climate and environment, a lot of the planning that happened for kind of social and economic reasons through things like the New Deal set up a lot of that infrastructure of money to come from the top down. So I'm talking especially in the US from the federal government to invest in things like highways and transportation and that kind of infrastructure. So I think there certainly has been a top down approach to planning in a lot of cities from that kind of federal government money going down. But I think that that's also changed a little bit in the past few decades as we think about what more distributed approaches look like.
And I guess before we get into the details on top-down versus bottom-up approaches to planning, which you discuss in your paper on the Green New Deal, which we'll discuss in a bit, I wanted to ask you, on a more personal note, how did you start thinking, writing, and working on just transition planning, energy transitions more broadly? What motivated you to undertake this work?
Yeah, it's a fun question. Since I got into college as an undergrad, and then I'm a first generation college student, I didn't even know if I would go to college or not. I started getting really interested in climate change. That was really starting to come up in the discourse of the time as what are we going to do about this? And I thought, well, I want to work on this. I don't know how. I don't know if I want to be a scientist. I don't know if I want to be a journalist. But I kept taking classes and also getting involved in activism. And I think that you start to figure out where what you like to do. And I realized, well, I like to write and I like to communicate and I like to chat with people. And that kind of led me into planning as how do we have all of these ideas. And I think there's so many great ideas coming out of kind of all different sectors of society. How do we implement them? How do we get different people to the table to be able to talk about them, to be able to turn them into concrete plans? So yeah, there's an Annie Dillard quote that I really, really like. And she says, how you spend your days is how you spend your life. So I always say that when I talk about how I got to what I do, I just started trying to think about, well, how do I want to spend my days? Mostly chit-chatting. So that's how I got into planning.
That's great. Super relate to that. and all the things that you mentioned, and just kind of starting with caring about this issue and then going into the different phases of like who all works on this. In your exploration of that, were there other areas that kind of drew you in or that you thought, oh, maybe I'll do this or I will not do this? And were there any like rationales for that kind of thing?
No, I always really like to write. And so I was trying to figure out how can I kind of use that for the best possible, to make the most possible impact, and landed in planning where I get to do a good bit of both academic writing, but also much more public facing stuff, and getting to communicate with real people outside of the university.
Must be nice.
Yeah, real people outside of the academy. For sure, that must be nice. And we'll talk more about that, about building bridges between academic work and community organizing in a bit. But let's first talk about your paper on the Green New Deal. So for our listeners, you published a paper with Laura Landau in 2022 titled A New Framework for Imagining the Climate Commons, the Case of a Green New Deal in the US. In it, you analyze the Green New Deal that was put forward by AOC and Markey in 2019, which was, as you call it, arguably the most ambitious climate policy platform to gain legislative traction in the US to date. Your analysis is around the contents of the Green New Deal and how, in some regards, it pushes for policies and strategies that are market-driven, state regulation-driven, and community-driven, which are all happening at very different levels. And all of these are different modes of governance happening at different scales, which your paper does a wonderful job in articulating. First, let's give our listeners a brief refresher of what the Green New Deal is and how you've seen it operate in your work and in urban planning more generally.
So important to note, it was put forth as a resolution, which is non-binding. It is still something that gets voted on in the House and Senate in the US, but is not the same as a bill or a binding piece of policy. It's more kind of like a visioning document that helps to guide other policy. Unfortunately, it never advanced in the House or Senate, but I do argue that it paved the way for these much bigger conversations about what decarbonization can look like. So the Green New Deal that was proposed in 2019 proposes this 10-year mobilization plan that focuses on a transition to renewable energy, rapid infrastructure deployment, and economic development. And so as a whole, I think probably the most interesting thing about the Green New Deal and why I say it's so ambitious is that it looks at climate policy not in a vacuum, but tied to these broader conceptions of social and economic justice, which I think we are certainly really talking about that much more today. But I think when this was getting introduced, that was kind of like a, oh, we can think about these things all together, right? It's not like climate over here and inequality over here. I know I'm not supposed to talk with my hands on a podcast, note for listeners. But it's interesting in that way because it started to get us thinking more holistically. And I think actually thinking kind of optimistically in this opportunity framework as we address climate change, what else can we do? What is this an opportunity for? And so the Green New Deal is really this worker and community-led approach that is an investment-led approach focusing on kind of a massive government investment, similar to where it gets its name from the New Deal, which also kind of created in the 1930s, whole of government response to the Great Depression under FDR in the US, that focused on these three R's, quote unquote, that was relief for the unemployed, recovery of the economy, and reform of the financial system. And so out of the New Deal, we got a lot of these things that stick with us today that have informed policy in North America really broadly, like Social Security, a Federal Housing Administration, massive public works projects, including expanding electrification access to rural areas. And so the Green New Deal takes that investment-led approach, but does something slightly different in saying kind of normative. This should be community-led, and this can't be kind of defined really prescriptively for every community.
Right. So it takes into account that there are different contexts all across, and you can't just homogenize different cities or neighborhoods within cities, for example. I'm curious, in what ways does the Green New Deal try to empower bottom-up approaches?
So I think that the primary mechanism that the Green New Deal uses is taking that federal investment and distributing monies to communities to act on these self-defined priorities, which is why I think it has been, at least as this document as it stands, the 2019 resolution has been critiqued for being too vague, right? Like, what is it actually, what are we actually going to do? I don't see any projects in here. I've heard that a lot. And I think it's a really challenging bit because how do you put forth something specific and actionable at the federal level while also leaving enough room for community autonomy and for communities to define what those projects look like, which right might be different, very different in very different places, especially in a country as kind of big and diverse as the US, both from a demographic perspective, but also from a geographical perspective, from an economic and industry perspective. There are just different things happening in different places and different types of transitions that are already well underway.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you so much for explaining it in such detail. I remember actually the moment the Green New Deal was in the House and Senate, I was like a senior in my undergrad, and it was a big mobilizing moment, not only in the Congress itself, but I think it also sparked, or maybe was there was a reciprocal, like cyclical action there with a lot of environmental movements and like Fridays for the Future, with Sunrise, Extinction Rebellion, etc. So there was maybe this, what you're calling top-down and bottom-up approach around the legislation itself as well. But now that we're kind of talking about these tensions, that's a big part of this paper as well, is these tugs between the different approaches to climate governance. Do you think you could talk a little bit more about this, and also maybe addressing the part where it's a worker and community-led approach on self-defined priorities? Like, have you seen instances of communities taking the framework and doing something with it, or has it been more so just in a like more ideas-based narrative that is the main thing that's being carried forward from this period of time?
That's a great question. And I think the answer is definitely yes. Communities, I have seen examples of communities using it. And just to back up and say, I think the other very cool thing about the Green New Deal that you just alluded to is it's really not just this developed in the hallways of the US government, but really came and was very, very directly informed by activist movements and from people on the ground and their priorities and what they want. So I think, right, Fridays for Future, the Sunrise Movement, there's a very kind of youth-led, worker-led approach that this wasn't just like the Green New Deal started in or came online in 2019 as an idea, but had been really in development and being talked about. I think kind of the first mentions, I was looking this up the other day, like who said it first, which, you know, sometimes doesn't really matter, but sometimes is interesting. And I think a journalist said something about it in like 2007, 2008, using those words, saying like, okay, how can we do a new deal but green? And then it really evolved over that decade into the kind of ideology it's become now and kind of driving force. So to your question about how is this being used in communities, I think Los Angeles is one example that's passed their own Green New Deal. In climate planning, which is something that we'll talk about a little bit today, kind of at the community level, I think it's made a really interesting organizing framework. That said, I think it's also of the time can be a kind of polarizing buzzword for people. You know, where people hear Green New Deal and they think like, that's not for me, that's this leftist thing, which I think is really interesting because I don't think that that's true. I think, you know, at the heart of it, right, like we're trying to center workers and communities, and that includes everybody, whether you, how you identify politically or not, right? I think it's the point of it is that this is a transition for everyone that we want everybody involved in, and particularly communities that either feel that they have been left behind or really have been in transitions as industry has shifted both away from fossil fuels and fossil fuel production. Those are the people that need to be involved in this conversation.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the critique to the Green New Deal coming from the right. You know, it's seen as socialist, God forbid. But there's also definitely critique that comes from the left. And I'm thinking here about Max Eyal as one scholar who does this in his book, A People's Green New Deal. It's seen as not radical enough, and that it pushes for more nationalist forms of development and ignores some other fundamental questions, such as climate debt or social debt owed to the global South. I think critiques like these need to be taken into account. For example, militarism is something that needs to be engaged with when thinking about just transitions. And it seems like the Green New Deal as we know it, the one we've been discussing, doesn't quite do that. Yet, we are talking about a national policy here, and there is a lot to scrutinize domestically on how just the Green New Deal is. On that, I guess, I wonder if you can talk to us about the tension between place-based and local contexts and the scalability that's necessary to enable large-scale energy projects. What do you think is the appropriate balance here, if there is one?
It's a hard question because I think what we're doing kind of as a political and social project is trying to find that balance, right? I don't think that there is a good answer where I could tell you, there is some ideal modeled balance between what we need to do in communities and what we need to do at the federal government, right? It's at this point, especially I often, which is definitely something that is very kind of positivist or you know, from a more scientific basis, that can we be informed by models of these projections of where we think climate change is headed, and then what type of policy we need in response. And while I think we can, usually the answer is all of the above, right? Like, let's do everything we can and see what sticks. To your point about kind of the Green New Deal in an international context, I mean, I think it's been widely discussed in Europe. But I think there's something interesting about, I mean, there are certainly texts, and I point to that in the paper, about how they envision the Green New Deal positioning the US, right, especially as basis of sharing knowledge, of sharing technology with other countries. But it doesn't have all that much to say about the US internationally, right? I think one thing, and this is kind of something that I didn't write about and I'm thinking about a little bit on the spot, is, well, where you say you're going to put your money means that there is money that will go to some things and not other things, right? It's always a trade-off. So I think that that's one good thing, right? If we say where we are putting our money into this, especially kind of nationalist, right? Like, we're investing heavily in our country and in our people, does leave theoretically less money for military spending and some of these other things that I think are maybe go less well hand in hand with what we need to do to mitigate climate change.
Right. I mean, it seems like when it comes to the Green New Deal, and you all illustrated this very well with these concentric circles in your paper, where, you know, the local, regional, federal, international levels are all, you know, one within the other, and they're all sort of aligned in this broader policy framework, and they're all part of the solution. I know, like, also we've talked about, you know, contexts in which the community needs and desires may be actually in contradiction with those of policymakers and developers, such as, you know, for example, when a large-scale energy project says we need to, you know, reach this amount of solar or wind by this date, and these communities need to be on board in order for that to happen. And certain communities might say, actually, like, you know, either on a more NIMBY kind of level, like, we don't want wind turbines because they're ugly, or they have, you know, legitimate concerns about changing the landscape and not having been consulted to build those projects. And I know that planners kind of engage in this community engagement process in order to try to reconcile some of these things. Do you think you could speak a little bit more to that, when these scales seem to be more in tension with one another, as opposed to being able to be united under a common solution?
Oh, I love that, because that's kind of what I'm thinking about all the time, right? And that's why I got so interested in the Green New Deal. And actually, I'll point to, for anybody that wants to read more about the Green New Deal and planning, Kian Go, who teaches at UCLA, has a really nice paper about kind of like, what is planning, what does the Green New Deal mean for planning, and how does it change scale and space in this way that we need to adapt to it, which how can we use this to adapt? So I think we're kind of thinking all the time, right, about like, okay, what do we need to happen at the federal level at these that, you know, that just can't by definition happen at a local level? What kind of decisions in order to facilitate local action? And I think in that kind of vagueness of the Green New Deal does leave a lot of opportunity for those community-defined solutions, especially if there's money to back them up. I think One challenge, and maybe not speaking directly to your question, but is something that we've been talking about a lot lately with the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, which I think people might disagree with me here, hot take. I think in this new legislation, I think I have like a quote on my screen right now of like, no, I don't support the Green New Deal, Biden in first presidential debate with Trump in 2020. So despite Biden saying like, no, I'm not supporting the Green New Deal, I think the Inflation Reduction Act and bipartisan infrastructure law do have some of that spirit in terms of talking about good paying jobs, talking about revitalizing communities through production, and especially some things that the US government has done recently with Justice 40 that says that 40% of this federal money has to go to what are identified as environmental justice communities. So I think there is this framing that's seeped in, right? Like whether you want to use the buzzword or not. But what I was getting at is that I think one problem is it does become difficult when you make this money difficult for communities to access, when communities need professional grant writers to be able to access this kind of money. I think that does make it really hard. And that's something that we have to tackle. Something that planners, I think, have been thinking a lot about is, right, then you automatically have this bias built in of like, well, the wealthiest communities who have paid staff to do this stuff are going to have a better shot at getting the money. So how do we remove that kind of already biased competition angle to actually give communities the money? And of course, there's power dynamics within communities. It's not just like, okay, this is equitable because we give money to communities. I think this is a little bit meta, but something planners think about a lot is like, what is a community? Communities are changing. People are immigrating, people are moving, people are growing older, places are getting younger, communities are kind of changing all the time. So how do we conceive of a community? And I think this is a good kind of geography bit is like, what are the boundaries? Is it solely place-based? What about ideological communities? What about communities of identity? And so thinking, I think, really strategically about where we want this money to go, how we want people to be able to access it, and how that can become equitable, or the processes can be more equitable, I think is a really important piece there. And thinking about, well, how do we actually translate this to make these actionable things happen at the community level, and kind of, for lack of a better word, trickle down. Like, I think we don't want the like, here's some money, like, let it go to where it needs to go, because whose hands will it be in, right? I think there needs to be intentionality behind how we're funding projects, how we're funding communities, what those criteria are.
That's very interesting. It's actually something I wanted to ask you, like if the Inflation Reduction Act has any influence from the Green New Deal, and I'm glad you brought it up because I was curious about it. But as you were speaking, I was kind of wondering on the point of how the money gets distributed to communities, and yeah, like just access, community access to that money, having to write grants, etc. I'm just curious. Do you know, like, I can easily imagine a big renewable energy project or electric vehicle production or whatever, tapping into credits or incentives from the IRA, Inflation Reduction Act. But I'm curious at the community level, like what kind of projects are being proposed? Do you have some examples?
There is so much in the IRA. I think that's one of the interesting things is that like certain things get picked up by the news, right? Especially I think the things that they think are going to be very clickable. Like, what is the rebate I can get for an electric vehicle? That is a very clickable thing. But I think there is a lot of money for communities. There is some money for electrification. There's money for, charging infrastructure more broadly. I wish I had a good example at hand, but there's a lot in there. And I mean, I think that there's also, especially when you look at like the bipartisan infrastructure, we're thinking about, right? How do we actually build out this infrastructure, which is going to go beyond the community level and really think about connecting communities? And some of this stuff, right? As you were mentioning, when do the priorities kind of not align? I do think that there's necessary infrastructure that not all communities will like or be okay with, for kind of what Erica pointed out, whether you think those reasons are good or bad. I think, you know, many of them, they are still all reasons, whether it's ugly, or it deals with complex land rights, and ownership of land. When we think about the level of transmission that we need to really electrify, it's a lot. And so I think there will be conflict there. I try to be hopeful that we can do a good job at communicating it, and also do a good job at kind of compensating people and compensating communities, so they aren't disproportionately harmed by the impacts of an energy transition.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I think to me, just it's coming up as we're talking about this, is like, as a, you know, person coming into political consciousness around the time of the Green New Deal, I think it was the first kind of narrative that I heard that really like spoke to environmental justice and the connections between climate issues and workers' rights and racism and like all of these kind of interconnected pieces that was on the federal level. And to me, that's like why it was the most impactful thing. And I think that the movement has shifted kind of as a result as well. So not to be, you know, sound like a broken record, but I'm just kind of making these connections as we're talking. But yeah, I think now maybe we can transition into speaking to some of your other projects, just to kind of ground our listeners a little bit on what all planners might do a little bit on the ground as well. So I wanted to ask you about some of the efforts you've been part of to reduce emissions on campuses. My understanding is that these have brought together people from various fields, academics, planners, behavioral scientists, and community members as well, to help universities achieve net zero carbon emissions. And I think universities are like a very interesting kind of microcosm of society here, where we can really like get at what are the different tensions and different stakeholders and winners and losers kind of involved in an effort like this. Do you think you can start by maybe just painting a picture of what these projects are about, how they've formed, and the various actors that are involved?
Yeah, and I can talk a little bit about, this is, you know, kind of part of my lore and how I really started to get involved in climate, and how I started to think about these things as kind of as kind of my scholarship and my work and my activism as one thing, which is often hard and complicates your life a little bit when you're not sure if you're working or volunteering or doing something that, or you know, engaging in activism. But I did actually both undergrad and graduate school at Rutgers in New Jersey. And there is where I really started to get involved with, well, I'm here and I'm on this campus, and Rutgers is a pretty big part of actually the state government in New Jersey. When you look at like who is spending money, a lot of it, you know, is on the state budget. Rutgers has three large campuses throughout the state, so there are a lot of emissions associated with the school and just a lot of money going through. And I think there's two pieces that I want to talk about here. And before I kind of tell you the rest, is that I think these, what has been in tension with each other, is reducing emissions directly on campus and divestment, or what universities do with their money. And so often the organizing is, for better or worse, separate, that they're different decision-making bodies, especially at large universities, right, that are dealing with each of these issues. So I've been involved in both. At Rutgers, the president's office put together a task force that I was on as a student representative for, thinking through how do we do this on campus, right? Like what, through what mechanisms? And it was, that was my first kind of taste of like, oh, you can get a lot of very different people involved in this. I mean, there are a lot of kind of physical scientists and biological scientists and modelers, and also geographers and social scientists, and students doing, you know, entirely, you know, coursework entirely unrelated to climate, but who really cared a lot about it, thinking about, well, what should our priorities be? So most of my work there was less on kind of like, well, what specific actions should we take to reduce emissions, but more around how do we engage the student body and make sure that students have a say in what's going on here, that they're sufficiently engaged and it's not a kind of decide, announce, defend model like we often see in planning of there's been a decision, we're telling you what it is, and the only option now is for students to get out and protest because they don't like it, that to be consulted much earlier, which is a great practice, right, for thinking about how do we do this anywhere, how do we do this in any community, right, like what do these processes look like. So I got involved there, and then when I was at Princeton doing a postdoc, I worked a little bit on their Princeton Energy project about thinking about reducing emissions. And it was actually kind of dovetailing with a really big success of disassociation with fossil fuels at Princeton, which is slightly different than divestment, and I won't entirely get into it. But kind of happened all at the same time. And so, yeah, it was really interesting to work with that many people at Princeton. Definitely worked with a behavioral science consulting company, Evident, that I've gone on to continue collaborating with that are great. I've thought a lot about kind of how we need to change hearts and minds, but, you know, kind of through where is the most effective kind of place to focus when we're thinking about these things. And what I'll say about that is that it's not always what is the most effective emissions reductions tool. Like what's going to reduce the most emissions on paper, I think might not always be the thing that you should focus on the most, right? Like what is going to kind of build a culture of sustainability in a place might be different than, you know, the kind of one isolated decision that reduces energy use, which we should also do. But they kind of become these two different pieces.
Yeah, totally. That kind of reminds me of a bit on the community engagement kind of question. Again, I'm sorry I keep coming back to this, but you know, this is a topic I'm very interested in. But the, you know, what you're saying about engaging students every step of the way, kind of countering the what I've seen to be kind of more of the dominant strand of community engagement and planning, that's been more so what you said, like the decide and then convey, and I don't remember what the exact three words were, but it seems like more so a check mark, like, oh, we already have this goal that we're going to now impose on you, and we want you to be on board, but basically as like one of the factors that lead to the goal being achieved, as opposed to actually engaging on the basis of like respecting their opinion and like actually wanting to form the goals together. Do you feel like that was a challenge or tension in student engagement between like different folks that were involved? Or was it kind of people were on the same page about the importance of student engagement?
Oh, wouldn't it be so wonderful if everybody's on the same page all the time? You know, I think it was specifically in university organizing, the biggest challenge I came up against is that this on campus, what can we do on campus, and divestment were two different issues that the same students were really interested in, but different decision-making bodies were making. So like, for example, at Rutgers on the student task force, divestment would come up a lot in the meetings. And I think especially some of the faculty and staff that we were working with at the time were like, it's not that we don't want to hear those concerns. It's that we can't do anything about that. That like we aren't tasked with making those recommendations on this task force. And that's a different decision-making body. And so what kind of had to happen was these two parallel organizing efforts, even though they felt very much like the same issue to students. So I think, you know, we also saw that at Princeton, where in a lot of conversations I was having with students at the time, it was like, okay, like I don't want to see another sign in my dorm telling me to like turn off the water when I know that the university is giving, you know, investing millions of dollars in fossil fuels. Like, why should I care? And I understand that sentiment. But what I always try to kind of talk about is like, it's not an either or, it should be a both end. Like we can be advocating for both of those things. Like we can be doing a better job on campus, and not only to reduce emissions, right, but to build that culture of sustainability. That's how you kind of also draw people in who might not know about these kind of other higher level political things that are going on, is by these kind of simple, you know, tabling things on campus or sorting your food waste. I think some of those things are really good entry points for people. And as we think about campuses, we need to think about like, what are people taking with them off campus when they leave and go do whatever work that they're going to do? How are we kind of trying to start build a culture of that that really persists, where people are questioning what's going on and hopefully can then take that to their employers? I think that was a big focus at Princeton all around. Like, I think like that is one place where everybody was on the same page. They're like, we do want to build this culture, but how, you know, everybody kind of had different ideas about doing that.
Yeah. What do you think? Like, what is a culture of sustainability look like from your perspective?
We were talking about this in a different seminar yesterday in a different context. It was like, how do you know what a culture of transportation is in a city? Like, do different cities have different cultures of transportation? And there was some debate of like, I don't know, you can just tell like whether it's a transit city or a driving city, and like what kind of builds and reinforces that. But I think it's kind of like you know if it's there, a culture of sustainability. But I do think, as much as it's hard to talk about those individual decisions, because a longer conversation for another time about how carbon footprints have been kind of weaponized by the fossil fuel industry to shift responsibility onto the individual, I don't think it's not important. I think still doing all of the things that we can do, you know, what's in your own locus of control is an important piece, just maybe not for the reasons that we might think it is. And one of the stories that I like to tell to this point is that my mother-in-law, who I'm really, really close with, you know, wasn't super, you know, informed on kind of environmental stuff, but her daughter, my sister-in-law, got a master's in environmental journalism, and there's the work that I do, and so she kind of started getting more and more interested. And at one point she sent me this article of an artist that had collected a bunch of trash from beaches and sorted it kind of by color. It was all plastic, and the art installation was really beautiful. But for some reason, like, that was the thing that just stuck with her. That was like, she saw that and she was like, I had no idea. Like, I couldn't fathom the amount of waste that's going into the oceans. And so there's more than just our individual recycling efforts that will go into that. But that was the thing that spoke to her. And now, in a totally unrelated vein, she's like very into wildlife conservation. And now that she's retired, she's been like volunteering with local habitat organizations. She's super into birds. And like, that became kind of like her thing. Like, how can I make a difference here? Which I think actually really is impactful. You know, she's having a direct impact on like trying to preserve biodiversity in the place that she lives in, New Jersey. So I think everybody needs an entry point. And the more entry points that we can develop is kind of the culmination of that culture of sustainability.
Yeah, I agree with that. And thank you for sharing that story. I think when you realize that a lot of sustainability discourses place blame on individuals and carry this discourse that if every individual started caring more, then the world would be a much better place. And when you criticize this discourse as something that's blind to systemic dynamics, you kind of begin to feel like individual action is quite futile. At least that's how I started feeling a while ago. But when you explain it in this way, that a culture of sustainability can be an entry point to something more meaningful than sorting your waste and going vegan, like joining a movement and doing work that is considered much more political, In this sense, a culture of sustainability entails politicization, and I do appreciate this framing, so thank you for that. I think on that note, since we're getting a little hopeful and we like to end our podcast with a little glimmer of hope, I want to ask you, what gives you hope? What keeps you going, Holly?
This is my favorite question. We have our last class in just energy transitions today, and I'm going to pull just that out of students. What makes you hopeful? I think it's the most important point to end on. I think though we might have a lot of reasons to be anxious, to be worried, to at times feel like there's not hope, we have so much to be hopeful about. And that's what drives me and that's what drives my work. Something I didn't really get to talk about today, and I don't have anything published on yet, but is a work in progress that I'm headed to the American Association of Geographers Conference to talk about, is work on mutual aid and how mutual aid organizing is playing a really important role in community response to extreme weather events. And so really, like, the work that I've done kind of personally and academically and politically in mutual aid and organizing has given me so much hope. I think that if there's any individual action that anybody can do to help the climate, if anybody, you know, that's sometimes a question that I get, like, what's the thing I should do? What's the most important thing? Should I get an EV? Should I get an e-bike? I think it's help somebody in your community. And that doesn't sound necessarily climate related, but that's, I think, what's going to get us where we need to be, is building, just like a culture of sustainability, a culture of community care and caring for each other, that helps us care for the environment, that helps us live less in isolation, which I think is really necessary for any of the collective action solutions that we need. And I see so many people doing really amazing things. I'll call out one group, Mutual Aid Disaster Relief. That's a network of people from all over the country that responds to extreme weather events, and who are also just like the coolest group of people ever. Like, I think that there's a lot of love and hope and joy in the connection that's required for all of this work. And that's what keeps me going. Also, getting to teach the next generation of people that will come in and work on these things is just the best. I mean, sometimes my students just have like crazy brilliant ideas because they haven't been involved in the conversation for so long that they lose sight of, like, you know, oh, that's impossible, or like, we can't do that. Like, I think encouraging people to think outside of the box, and to just be in community with each other has really been the best part of my work, the part that keeps me going, and the part that I think planning kind of has the most to contribute to.
So this was our conversation with Holly Caggiano. We hope you found it as fruitful as we did. A big thank you to Holly for joining us and contributing to our project. And thank you to our listeners. If you've stuck around to this point, we thank you for your engagement. It would be wonderful if you could leave us some feedback, as we are new to this and we would love to get better and better at this. Once again, thanks for listening and stay tuned for more.